good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portut. It's been a while since I've talked to all of you out there. Hope everything's been going good for you on this holiday season. Things have been going really well here. Let me turn my mic up a little bit. Yeah, things have been going really well here. A lot of good activity on the website, of course, thesportsinquirer.net. We've provided some good content with mixed martial arts power rankings, NBA power ranking, even did some NBA content with, I actually attended the Hawks-Pacers game last night, and there's a good story recapping that activity, and also some vintage video that we're dealing with. We're going to have something relation to the NBA and everything associated with that. So it's going to be a really good time as far as getting some good content out there. Today we're going to talk about college football, get to some NFL football and miscellaneous news and notes, as well as recapping those MMA power rankings that we discussed or that I put up on the site. If you want to contact us, you can always go to thesportsinquirer.net. Follow us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. Facebook under The Sports Inquirer, and then you can subscribe to us on iTunes as well. That is always a viable option. We're going to take our first break. And when I come back, I'm going to delve into the national title game in college football between Auburn and Florida State here on the podcast. All right, welcome back to the podcast. Your host, E. Marcel Portut, once again. Let's delve into that national title game and break it down from several angles. First of all, good effort by both teams. Both players, both teams, you can tell that they were the two best teams throughout the entire season, and a lot of guys made money on that contest. The coaching was solid overall for Auburn. I really don't know what you can really fault them for outside of going for that fake punt in the second or third quarter when Florida State was really struggling. Florida State was really out-coached greatly during the first 2.5 quarters of that game. They made some good adjustments on the defensive end, and I'm going to delve into why I was able to see those adjustments into the actual telecast of the contest. Jameis Winston adds to his legacy, redshirt freshman national champion. Only one incomplete pass in the final two possessions, and they both ended in touchdowns. He had his struggles in the first half, which is very evident. Overthrew some bad throws overall, really didn't use his legs properly, but he saw that he calmed down, got it together, and got the victory. Interesting fact from it, with Jimbo Fisher, after they won the championship, saying that this was for the ACC. I don't really delve into the whole conference loyalty aspect of it. As those of you listening know, I went to Vanderbilt, which is an SEC school. I don't really get excited when Mississippi State does well in a bowl game or Alabama or Auburn winning the past few national championships. It's not a feather in my cap as a fan of an SEC team that another squad wins the game. So I don't really understand that whole aspect. Maybe because from my perspective, the team I support is actually part of a conference that does really well on the national stage. So that's where I don't really find any issues or concerns when it comes to, you know, dealing with it. But he mentioned that he was happy for the ACC, and as fans of Boston College and Georgia Tech and Miami can take some excitement in seeing another team in their conference win a title. I mean, that's whatever. I've never understood that loyalty aspect. But anyway, and we've delved into that in the past about why I think teams, we talked about in the Southeastern Conference, why they feel that winning a championship is just really a pride of an entire part of the country. And maybe I'll delve into that in the next episode a little bit further, looking at really the cultural representations of what people try to find with the success of teams in the conference. Well, actually, and then also, let's talk about the technology and the media aspect of it as far as the sport growing overall. Every major sporting event that we've had in the past 2-3 years, you continue to see the growth of social media. I was on Twitter the entire ball game, which is something that conceptually was not possible 10, 20 years ago. I think a lot of times, and people still gather at a local bar or outside area or have some friends over to watch the ball game, but I think it's, you see the impact of interacting with other people from around the world, literally, by watching the contest with that social media aspect. Traditional broadcasting, I think, is almost going to be dead in 20 years, like terrestrial radio. And what I mean by that, and I've noticed this on a personal level, because I actually have a trial subscription to Sirius XM Radio because of a new car that I have, and I barely listen to terrestrial radio anymore. Terrestrial radio is AM and FM radio signals. I hardly listen to that anymore. I listen to all of the satellite radio, whether it's for music, for comedy, things like that. News, traffic, that's what I use it for. And you see ESPN, I think, realizing that as well. They had a traditional broadcast with Brent Musburger and Kirk Herbstreit, and they also had some alternative options, which we're going to delve into right now. As far as traditional broadcast of the game, I did watch that because you do like hearing some voices while the game is going on. This hurts me to say this because I've been a fan of his work for a very long time. And if you're in any sports broadcasting interest or any desire to follow it or be in the career, Brent Musburger is the apex of it. He's covered every sporting event possible. But you're starting to see him really slow down, and I think he's reached a certain age where you can't fire him and kick him out the door. But I think his contract is maybe going to be up at the end of this year. I think it may be time for him to go back to the studio and do television sports programming from that side of things and less on the play-by-play. I think I saw him miss multiple plays, just a slow pace to calling the game. I think you have some other guys out there who will do a better job of it. And that's why I really didn't watch that side of it. So then I turned to ESPN2. And ESPN2 had a good, I think, intention with it. They were trying to show when I talk about watching a ball game with other people in a social setting, like face-to-face, that's what they tried to do. They had I don't know what the term is of what they called it. But what they did is that they had I think it was hosted by Jemele Hill and Michael Smith, and they would have different personalities and actors and college people come and watch the game with them, I believe from a skybox or from somewhere in the stadium, and they're watching the game and reacting to it. There was just so much going on with it. It was a cluster at times. It was too many people, too many voices. And while I thought, Scott Van Pelt and Ryan Russillo did a very good job of it, You got to have some more consistency with it. Because one minute I flip to it, you have James Franklin and Johnny Manziel there. Then you turn, next minute is Todd McShay talking and Michael Smith trying to get his stuff in. I think they limited the roster a little bit to that. The intention was good. I don't think it got the best reception from the stuff I read out in the media. And I don't think many people liked it. But I see what they're trying to do something different. I understand that. It wasn't my cup of tea, but, conceptually, that could use some work. The ESPN film room, I thought, was incredible. And for those of you who did not watch it, what they did is that they had Tom Luganville, Matt Millen, and Chris Spielman, who are each ESPN analyst commentators, and they were joined by Kevin Sumlin of Texas A&M, and these are all the head coaches of these teams. Kevin Sumlin, Steve Adazio from Boston College, and Pitt's Paul Christ, and they broke down the game film while it was taking place. So what you in essence saw were the six of them, or seven of them, excuse me, sitting there watching a game from the coach's angle. And usually the coach's angle is more, it's not like the sideline angle, it's more of the sky cam. And they would watch the game and try to break down the plays as it was going on. So in essence, if you've watched any of those film breakdown sessions that are in all the pregame shows that will show Team X was in this defensive formation, Team Y was running this type of offense, and you saw the game film of what they were trying to do, you saw that happen in live session. So that's what. So every play, you'd have Matt Millen or Chris Spielman, probably more defensive guys, talking about, okay, they're running this base. They're trying to get these defensive linemen to do this angle. And then some more offensive guys like Kevin Sumlin and Steve Adazio would look at the offensive line play, especially with Auburn. There was a lot more to talk about because of their run scheme. And them breaking it down while it was going on was, if you're a football geek like me that really likes to look at the breakdown of the plays, it was really well done. It eliminated a lot of the chatter that you hear with the broadcast and trying to fill all of that time up when you just have two people in the, you know, in the press box or commentating on the game. If you have a traditional broadcast, you saw the guys are very comfortable just talking about the film, not having to do with X's and not having to break down Nick Marshall snap to Nick Marshall, hand off to Trey Mason, runs 5 yards down the right side for a first down, second and 10 from the 30, or second and 5 from 30, things like that. They didn't have to do any of that stuff. They just talked about the game directly. And you saw guys like Asazio get very excited about talking about the line play of Auburn, the offensive linemen, and their blocking schemes. So seeing that type of stuff was really great. And I think it's something that has a really good future overall in the broadcast industry. We're on it. We're in an on-demand culture, and while they can't pull this off, I think for every game, it's a national title game. You have all of the. I think they said there are 22 to 25 cameras on the game. You're not going to have that for every single contest, and that's where some people are saying they like to see it more often. That's not going to be the case. This was a special occasion, national championship. All eyes were watching this game. But it would be interesting to see an NFC or AFC title game take place like this. I don't think we'll ever see the Super Bowl have this type of scenario, because the NFL and whoever owns the broadcast, I think Fox has it this year. All of the eyes are going to be on Fox for the advertising dollars. Now, sure, there are advertising dollars with this BCS national title game, but not as much as the Super Bowl. And you don't want eyes diverging to the different options for, you saw with the college football game, for the NFL. And that's why you will not see a film breakdown, a film room for the Super Bowl, because all of the advertisers are going to want all of the eyes, all the people watching the game, to focus in on one network. So Fox Sports 1 is not going to have a film room, or even do with like ESPN 2 have a watch party, in essence. That's not going to happen. But I think for the future, for college football games, or even for the AFC and NFC title games, maybe they can, and it's going to be too short of notice for it to happen this year. But definitely for next season in the college football and with the NFL, I think you'll see this take place more often, because people are going to want more options to see the game, and they want to diversify the choices they have as far as watching the contest. So those are my thoughts on the actual game itself. If you wanted me to break down a little bit more of the actual X's and O's of it, just shoot me an email or shoot me a Twitter message. You can always, you know how to contact me there. We're going to take our next break, and when I come back, I'm going to break down my mixed martial arts power rankings here on the podcast. All right, welcome back to the podcast. Even Marcel Portute with you. And I have my mixed martial arts power rankings on the website, thesportsenquirer.net, so you can really look at a bigger breakdown of where I think each of the fighters are within their particular divisions. But I'm going to give you kind of a Cliff Notes version of what I wrote down on the site, because I know a lot of you like to listen to the show as an alternative to reading some of my content, and that's fair. So I'm going to go into just the different divisions. And it's been a while since we did a power ranking. I think my last power ranking may have been back in November of last year, 2013. So we've had, and maybe even further back than that, maybe September. So we've had some different champions that have developed, that have come since then. A lot of major fights have taken place, major injuries, and future matchups that have been announced. We're going to get into all of that, I think, as we break down these different divisions. We'll start with the big boys up at heavyweight. Number one, I have Cain Velasquez. Number two, Junior Dos Santos. Fabricio Werdum at number three. Daniel Cormier at number four. And Travis Brown at number five. Now, Velasquez has clearly established himself as a top heavyweight in the world, courtesy of the two dominating victories we've seen him have over Junior Dos Santos. However, that the shoulder injury that he has suffered, that's going to keep him out of the rest of 2014, most of 2014. I think we're seeing maybe the fall or of 2014 for his recovery to come back from it, means that the rest of the division is going to have to fight each other off for the time being. Now, Dos Santos has unfortunately delved into the unfortunate position of being better than everyone else in the division except the champion. So what that means is he's going to have to bide his time, I guess, until Velasquez loses. And when he loses, maybe Dos Santos can get a shot at that new champion. Personally, I'd like to see Travis Brown get a shot at Dos Santos as a test for the Hawaiian's path towards the championship. Really impressed with his victory over Josh Barnett, and one of the most impressive performances of 2013. And that will really be, I think, a good opportunity to see if he's ready to step up to the next level and get to Velasquez probably when he comes back, as I said, later this year. I have Cormier number four right now, but this is going to be the last time you'll probably see him in the rankings, because now he's moved down to light heavyweight. He's going to face Rashad Evans next month, and that's going to be a really interesting fight that we're going to delve plenty into when we get to that point. The Mir-Overeem fight that's coming up also intrigues me, and those two guys were outside of my top five. If I did a top ten, they would probably have been in the bottom half of that. But that, if I interest me, first of all, two guys I really enjoy watching. Mir, I'm a personal fan of, one of my favorite fighters of all time on a personal level, not outside of being an analyst. So I always follow his career and want to see him do well. Alistair Overeem, very disappointing performances in the UFC. Travis Brown, he's lost to Antonio Bigfoot Silva. He really needs a win. And obviously, if you're a fan of mixed martial arts, you know all the controversy or drama that he has outside the cage with some medications that he may take to improve his performances, if you get what I'm saying. So really interested in seeing that fight as well. Mark Hunt almost made my top five as well. Impressive draw against Bigfoot Silva, who also missed out the top five. Interesting division. People say that doesn't have a lot of depth to it. I think it does have. It's not as deep as some of the other divisions that we're going to delve into in the lighter weight classes, but I don't think it's as dire as people make it out to be. So that was my heavyweight rankings. Light heavyweight, number one was John Jones. Two, Alexander Gustafsson. Number three, Rashad Evans. Four, Glover Teixeira. And five, Phil Davis. Jones and Gustafsson was on my short list of 2013 Fight of the Year. And I'll announce it was the Fight of the Year. I'll give it that distinction. We finally have a light heavyweight that physically can match up with Jones in a Swede who I felt initially deserved immediate title rematch. I thought Gustafsson did enough to earn that. However, thinking back on it and trying to look at it from the promoter perspective from Zuffa and the UFC, I'm an advocate of Teixeira as well. He's won 20 consecutive fights, has looked very impressive in his stint in the UFC, including that dominating technical knockout win over Ryan Bader. I understand giving him the shot against Jones, and whoever wins that, Gustafsson, I think, deserves to get that next guy. So it really extends the division now a little bit more by not having that immediate rematch. And we'll see what happens when we go from there. And once again, When we get to Jones Teixeira, I'll break that fight down. Teixeira, I think, has a solid chance against Jones. The champ's going to have to come with a really strong effort, I think, to keep his belt. Rashad Evans is my number three. Impressive win over Chael Sonnen, who, we must admit, was moving up a weight class, to be fair. But the thing that's kind of disappoints me about Evans, if we saw that effort against John Jones, a guy he says he really disliked and had a lot of venom against, he might have been champion. That fight actually took place in Atlanta about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. And Evans' lack of aggression was very disappointing, and I think that's what cost him a chance to win the belt. Jones probably would have won the fight anyway. I had him winning the fight, but Evans should have been more aggressive in that contest, and now he's got to work his way back up the chain to get a chance at the title. And now he has a major player coming into the division, and Daniel Cormier, an Olympic wrestler, really tough, undefeated guy. He's going to be a major trouble for Rashad Evans. Really looking forward to that contest. And then Phil Davis and Dan Henderson, I kind of flip a coin between those two guys. And that's really the light heavyweight division so far, in my opinion. Middleweight, Chris Weidman's number one. Anderson Silva is number two. Vitor Belfort is number three. I actually predicted that Weidman would defend his belt against Silva in the fight we saw last month. I didn't predict the ending. I'm not going to delve into the Anderson Silva retirement talk at this time. It doesn't look good for a guy of his age suffering that type of leg injury. And I still think Weidman won that fight. The first round I gave to Weidman, and the second round obviously ended in the really bad fashion that it did, so I don't even really mark or score that round. But I thought Weidman was doing all the things that he needed to do to continue to show his superior skills to Silva. So I have no problem with putting Weidman number one. People are saying, oh, so the first fight he won was a fluke because of the taunting of Anderson Silva, and Silva got caught, and then the second fight ending with the broken leg of Silva. People aren't trying to give Weidman complete credit for those victories. He earned those wins, and broken body parts are a part of the game. It happens, and you can't look down somebody for winning if the opponent suffers an injury like that. I have Belfort number three. He looks like he's going to get Weidman sometime in the summer or the fall. I guess they're trying to figure out the technicalities of how to set it up. Interesting fight. Belfort has had a nice little run, and similar situation to Alistair Overeem with the medications that he has been allegedly taking, or not alleged, he has said he has been taking testosterone replacement therapy. And that's another section and another podcast to really break that down. But if you go by just on what he's been doing, he's become the main contender for that belt. So he's going to fight Weidman in the near future. Man, rest of the division, between Leola Machida, Jacare, Okami, Michael Bisping, Mark Munoz, each of them have their flaws in their own different ways. I just did not know how to really rank the fourth and fifth guy based on what we've been seeing from them. So that's why when I did my rankings, I really have the top three guys who I mentioned, and the rest of them in the other section. So if you have some critiques for me or want to help me rank those, contact me. I would love to hear it. Welterweight division. Out of respect, I have George St. Pierre number kind of... I don't have him one because he has retired. And when it comes to these rankings, if you are retired or... I know I had Cormier in the heavyweight division, even though he's technically going to be a light heavyweight. He still has not fought at light heavyweight. So until he makes that first, he steps in the octagon and throws that first punch or that first kick, he's still going to be in my heavyweight rankings. St. Pierre has retired, clear cut, no doubt. He has relinquished the UFC belt, so he is out of the rankings. But out of respect, he should still be mentioned. So on to the actual rankings. Johnny Hendricks is number one. Carlos Condit, number two. Robbie Lawler, three. Rory McDonald, four. And Jake Shields is five. I had Hendricks actually winning that fight 3-2 over St. Pierre. So even if St. Pierre did not retire, I would have probably put Hendrix number one personally. Once again, these are power rankings. These aren't the it doesn't matter if you have the belt or not. These are who I think are the best fighters in that particular division. So Hendrix is still listed number one for me, and he's going to face, I believe he's going to face Lawler in the very near future. Speaking of Lawler and Condit, right now I have Condit number two and Lawler number three. If you talk to me this time tomorrow night, I might have it flipped. Lawler might be my number two. And much respect to Lawler for several reasons. The guy who really had most of his career extensively has been outside of the UFC. Has fought in different promotions. We broke it down a few podcasts ago. And I'm trying to remember. He's fought in, I guess, King of the Cage, WEC, Elite XC, Strikeforce, obviously. So he has fought in multiple promotions and domestically and internationally. And now he's finally getting much due respect to fight for the belt in the UFC. So respect to him for all, if you're an older fan like myself, seeing him move up in this era. I have McDonald at number four. He's still a young guy that lost to a more experienced guy in Lawler. They fought a few months ago with Rory taking the loss. I think he'll get past this fight and get his career back on track. Jake Shields, who had a really tough loss to Damian Maya, that's another guy who I think will be okay. Disappointed as a media member and follower of the sport that Ben Askren and the UFC couldn't come to an agreement. I would have liked to see at least a return to Bellator so we could fight some better competition, but that bridge was obviously burnt for many reasons. Askren is now fighting in one fighting championship this spring, I believe, in Asia. Maybe if he looks impressive in that, he can come back domestically and fight in the UFC or maybe go back to Bellator. I don't know. And that's why just the lack of competition that Askren has fought, he's undefeated, I'll give him that, that's why he's outside of my top five. Moving on to the lightweight division, Anthony Pettis is number one, Benson Henderson two, Gilbert Melendez three, Eddie Alvarez four, and TJ Grant is fifth. This may be the most complete division in all of MMA. Michael Chandler, Josh Thompson, Nate Diaz, Khabib, they're all out of my top five, and you can make cases of several of them being there in that ranking. Pettis is the top dog, excellent win over Benson Henderson. He's actually defeated Henderson twice, major player. He's out with the injury as well, so that's going to be interesting to see what happens there. So now Benson Henderson is now going to face Josh Thompson in Chicago in a few weeks. So we're going to be interested to see what happens in that contest. TJ Grant is another guy who has been hit by the injury bug and would be, I think, a little bit higher, possibly, in my rankings if we saw some more activity from him. But once again, injuries are, those are the breaks. And then we're going to end it with the featherweight division, where I have Jose Aldo number one, Chad Mendez two, Ricardo Lamas three, Cub Swanson four, and Frankie Edgar as number five. It'd be great to see Mendez get another shot at Aldo, but the champ is going to have to wait, or Mendez is going to have to wait for the opportunity, because Lamas is going to get first crack at the belt next month, in a fight that I can see Lamas definitely being a major contender and winning that championship. Whoever wins that fight, I think, will get Mendez. Another old school fighter that's been around a while is Cub Swanson, who's number four in my rankings. Really good revival for him in the UFC. He is outside looking, lurking in, waiting for that title shot. And finally, Frankie Edgar. If he can get past BJ Penn, and I think he will, and that hurts as a Beach fan like me to say that, but I think he's a much better fighter at this stage than BJ Penn is. He's going to have impact in that title picture as well. He may need another win or two in the featherweight division to make that happen, but he's going to be a contributor to that title picture in the UFC. So those are my power rankings I have for mixed martial arts. Please go to the site as I go a little bit more in depth into each of these fighters when you read the article. But when we come back, we are going to finally delve into the National Football League and the wild card round that we just saw this past weekend, and then give a little bit of a preview of what we're going to see coming up over these next over this weekend. All right, we're here on the podcast. I'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the podcast. For you younger bucks out there, that was some Gap Band with Early in the Morning. You know, it's so funny, man. I put a lot of music up on my Facebook and on my Twitter, and I put some new artists that I'm into, whether it's hip-hop or rock or anything like that. But I'll get the most responses when I put that old-school stuff up, whether it's sports videos or it's music. And every time I put stuff up from, like, a Gap Band or even some old Sabbath, I get positive responses from that more than anything. And it's people even younger than me sometimes. I show love to the OGs. And speaking of that stuff, I also am starting a new option, or I don't call it a new segment, or a new feature. That's what we'll call it. We'll call it a feature on my site. And I'm going to call it Vintage Video Tuesday. So if you have any old school videos, sports-wise, that you'd like to see, really show that to me, and I can put it up, and we can discuss it. The reason I started it, well, the inspiration for it is, for some reason, actually, I know how it started, and then we'll get to the NFL. I was looking at some clips on YouTube, and it had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on there. Okay, no, here's how it is. Okay, it's a weird circle. BS Report, which is on ESPN, Bill Simmons, the sports guy who all of you are familiar with, he has his podcast called The BS Report, and he had Julius Erving on there, Dr. J. And they were talking about some of the greatest players of all time, and Dr. J says that Kareem is the greatest of all time, which is unique because a lot of people will name Michael Jordan, Bill Russell, even Wilt Chamberlain, Magic Johnson. Kareem, who is the all-time scoring leader in NBA history and has a lot of other records, is kind of overlooked, and I think the most underrated player in NBA history, which is odd seeing how he won, I think, 6 MVPs and at least 6 championships and all the stuff he did in UCLA and everything like that. So it's good to see Dr. J show him love. And you know how when you're on YouTube, you start a stream of things like, okay, I'm going to look at some old school Kareem highlights, and then I came across this video package of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in his younger days with the Milwaukee Bucks going against Wilt Chamberlain when he was in his older days with the Los Angeles Lakers, and just seeing a young guy versus a new guy during that time. And I saw that, and it was really good in-depth analysis of seeing how the game was played back then, the feelings both of them had towards each other. Really interesting stuff. So I put it up on the site, just a straight video, and got some positive reception from that as well. So we're going to make that a regular segment. And we're going to come up with some different things, maybe a new school Thursday. Or maybe I'll move it to, I know on Twitter a big thing is Throwback Thursday. Maybe we'll make a Vintage Video Thursday. We're kind of working on some things with that. So point being is that when I showed, I put the older stuff out there, it gets a better reception than when I put the new stuff. All right, so let's get to the NFL action here. Let's just go through these wild card games that took place this past weekend and kind of preview into what we're going to see, I think, this coming Saturday and Sunday. San Diego got that got a wild card win on the road over Cincinnati, 27-10. The Bengals seem like they're stuck in neutral. This seemed to be the year where you would think this would be when they make that next step. Baltimore had its issues. Pittsburgh is down. Cleveland is, well, Cleveland. They finally win the NFC North, or AFC North, excuse me. they get that home playoff game. The past 2 years prior to this one, they lost those road playoff games with this current group, with Andy Dalton, AJ Green, and such. So they finally get a home game against a San Diego team that needed some mini miracles just to make the playoffs. And then they lose at home. You know, the thing is that, and we deal with it a little bit here in Atlanta with Matt Ryan, where is your guy a championship caliber quarterback? I don't think Ryan is. Once again, another discussion for another day. I don't think Andy Dalton is a championship quarterback. You have to have a lot of help around him, and the Bengals just don't have that. But you're not going to release him either. We saw it with Jay Cutler, where the Bears looked at the current quarterback landscape and was like, what are our options? Do we choose a young quarterback and hope he develops into a great player like Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson have? And those are both situations where they're really good players that got in the right scenario and it worked out for both of those franchises. Or do we try to find a free agent, and their free agent options are not really great out there for quarterbacks? So you stick with that guy, like what the Bears did with Jay Cutler. The Bengals are stuck with Andy Dalton. Now, luckily for them, he doesn't cost that much money, and they're not in the renegotiation phase yet. This time next year, they're going to have to make a decision as far as keeping him or letting him walk or franchising him and all that jazz. But for now, you're stuck with Andy Dalton, which isn't a bad thing, but it just is what it is. As far as San Diego side, Philip Rivers, he shows that age makes even villainous people likable. Rivers is one of those guys who always seems like he has a cocky attitude on the field, really talkative, just a whiner. These are general perceptions I see from the outside, that you don't like him. But now that he's gotten older, he's been in the league about 10 years now, or close to it, he's now likable. He's kind of like Kobe Bryant in that regard. He's not the player that, as far as the accomplishments, they're not comparable. But Kobe Bryant's one of those guys, when he came in the league, he was young and he was a Shaq, and he had that cocky attitude that no one liked, and you're just like, you don't want to see him win. But he's been around for so long, you respect the OG, and that's what ties into the videos that I was talking about. You respect that old school, you know, mentality of just being aggressive, not really caring, and being a good competitor. So now I like Philip Rivers now. I kind of want to see him do well. I want to see him win that game. And I think San Diego, they have a decent chance of beating Denver. The Chargers won in Denver towards the end of the regular season on a Thursday night game. I think they caught the Broncos a little bit off. It was a short week. They were dealing with some injury issues as far as Denver goes. But now that Peyton Manning's had a 2 weeks of rest, Von Miller is working himself back into form, I think that they're going to be okay. And no, Von Miller's out. Excuse me. I'll talk about another guy who's working himself into full form, a defensive end in the other conference. But Von Miller's out. I mean, that hurts. But I think the Broncos have had enough time to adjust to that. Wes Welker with concussions, he's come back. He's going to be a good option for the Broncos. I'm going to take Denver to win that game, but San Diego's going to make it very, very close. Ryan Matthews is running the ball really well for them right now, and Antonio Gates is getting off the ball well. He looks like he has turned back the clock a little bit up in the tight end position. So they're going to score some points. I just don't think their offense is going to be able to keep up with the Broncos' offense on the other side, with the Chargers playing their defense. I think that's just going to be too much to deal with. Because the win in Denver, you're going to have to put up at least 30 points, maybe even more, to win that game. I don't see the Chargers offensively being able to keep up with that pace. New Orleans got a late second field goal to win over Philadelphia in their wild card game. Philadelphia, I think, is in the best shape of any team in the NFC East, which is really just fallen under the... It's a division that years ago used to be the best in the league. Yeah, every team outside of Philly was winning Super Bowls, making playoff appearances, and doing really well. But Philadelphia, I think, has maybe the best quarterback situation out of all of them. Because look at the quarterbacks in the NFC East. Eli Manning, worst year of his career. You don't know what's going on with him. Robert Griffin III, he's got a new coach to deal with Jay Gruden, which we'll get into that in our next podcast that we record. That will be out on Monday. But bad hire. We'll delve into that quite a bit. So the Redskins organization is just dysfunctional. The Cowboys, near the Cowboys, with Jerry Jones and Tony Romo and all that drama. Philadelphia has a good young quarterback, Nick Foles, I think is the truth. I think he's a really good player. You have a competent head coach, Chip Kelly. I did not see it when he came in, but he's a really good head coach, and I think he's going to be there for a while and do really well. You have Shady McCoy, LeSean McCoy, has another at least two good years in him that he's going to be a top-flight running back. DeSean Jackson looks like his head's together. He's playing well. Defensively, they lack a little bit, but you can always work on that. So Philadelphia, I think the sky is positive, or there's optimism on that side of things. Saints with a gritty win. That's going to serve them well against Seattle this weekend. That's going to be tough for them to go into Seattle, though, and win that game. I know earlier in the year, New Orleans got beat up very badly by the Seahawks. And while Pete Carroll said that game doesn't matter, sure, the actual reality of it doesn't matter. But I think that the Seahawks have stayed the same, and the Saints have not really improved enough to make up that gap. Now, if the game was in New Orleans, maybe a different story. But in Seattle, when that crowd is going, and the way the Saints operate, that's going to be a lot for them to handle. And while Rob Ryan's doing a good job with that defensive unit for the Saints, I think Seattle's due to break out and get a really good performance from Russell Wilson on that side of the ball and for them to get really going. So I'm picking Seattle to win that game. Indianapolis won over Kansas City 45-44. Alex Smith did all he could for the Chiefs. First quarterback in playoff history with 30 completions, over 300 yards passing. He had 378 yards, 4 touchdowns, and no interceptions, and lose the game. Just too many injuries for the Chiefs, particularly Jamaal Charles when he got hurt, and bad clock management in the fourth quarter. Really letting the clock run too much, bad timeouts. Andy Reid doesn't have the best reputation as far as managing the clock, and it did not help that reputation on Saturday. Andrew Luck threw 3 interceptions, threw 4 touchdown passes himself. He got the win. When it comes to the postseason, especially with these quarterback numbers, unless you're like Joe Montana back in 87 and 88, or Joe Flacco last year, who had double-digit touchdown passes and no picks, I really don't care how many yards you throw for, what your completion percentage is, what your quarterback rating is. If you win the game, that's really all that matters. Obviously, you'll have your outliers of 95% of the time, if Alex Smith put up those numbers in any other game, that'd be a win for his team. It wasn't on Saturday. But Luck threw 3 picks. They weren't good interceptions, but they won the game. So that's really all that matters at this stage of the season. They're going to go to New England. Obviously, he can't perform like that in New England. Patriots, while the defense has been banged up by injuries to Mayo and Wilfork, Jaron Mayo and Vince Wilfork, that Patriots defense is still good enough to give him trouble where he can't throw those type of passes and not expect those to be picked off. The Patriots offense, with Gronkowski being out, that really hurts them. But I think Tom Brady and the receivers are going to, it's be enough. They're going to squeak by the Colts at home. So far I've taken 3 home teams. So usually all 4 home teams don't win in this round, and that's where we get to San Francisco and Green Bay. 49ers came out and won that game 23-20 at Green Bay on Sunday evening. Green Bay's defense let them down in the end. That ultimately is what happened. From Clay Matthews being hurt to other guys underperforming, that's just really what happened in that contest. San Francisco, my concern, I'll get to the negative and then the positive. The concern is that they had those 2 long drives in the first quarter that they got down to the red zone and only got field goals. You're going to need to get touchdowns against Carolina this upcoming weekend for them to come out with a victory. Those long drives with Frank Gore running well, Michael Crabtree making receptions, even Vernon Davis getting involved in the offensive flow. You got to convert those into touchdowns, and kicking field goals in that situation is bad. The positive is that they were able to move the ball down the field and get to those stages, really sticking to the formula that they've established. And earlier in the season, what happened with the 49ers, and I've said it a few times on the podcast, that first game they played Green Bay in San Francisco, Colin Kaepernick threw for 300-plus yards, ran for more than 100, looked like a Superman superstar quarterback that's going to change the game. And they started having Kaepernick throw the ball a lot more than they really should have been with that identity of the team. And that's where you saw him drop some games in Indianapolis and some other odd losses and just not looking like the best team in the NFC, which they were last season. Then what happened is they went to that, remember, it was a Thursday night game at St. Louis. Frank Gore ran the ball for, I think, over 100 yards, played solid defense, and that's when they finally found their identity. You run the ball, you stop the run, you get some production from Kaepernick, running on the outside, converting third downs with his legs, and throwing it quite well also. And that's where you start seeing them get that identity going. And ever since then, they've been, I think, the best team in the NFC and possibly in the entire NFL. And that's why that formula is going to work against Carolina. Carolina's defense, I love how they play with Tommy Davis and with Luke Kuechly, who is probably going to be Defensive Player of the Year. Outstanding front seven. Good secondary, too. I just do not trust the Carolina offense scoring enough points against the 49ers defense, who's rounding in a form of Alton Smith and Justin Smith. And, of course, you have Bauer and Patrick Willis at the linebacker positions. I just don't think Carolina's going to be able to score enough to hang with the 49ers. So that's going to be my, I guess, I don't know what the line is. I need to check that, but no, 49ers are actually a road favorite, so that technically isn't an upset, but that's why I'm going to go with the 49ers to win that one. So those are my thoughts on the NFL. We're going to take our last break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into some other miscellaneous news and notes from the world of sports in my personal life, and preview what we're going to see next week, and what ruffled my feathers. And I think this is one that I can share with all of you out there in the United States, because no matter where you were, your feathers were ruffled by some coldness. We'll be back on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. During my vacation, I was still working the whole time. Christmas was good. I was thinking I haven't done a show since post-Thanksgiving, and then it was before Christmas. Christmas was good. I was actually here in the Atlanta area. Just relaxed, watched a lot of basketball. Really good time with that. Saw family kind of sporadically during the days before and afterwards, so took care of all that business. New Year's Day, spending at the Georgia Dome for the third year in a row, working the Chick-fil-A Bowl. Really fun times. Thank you once again to the Atlanta Sports Council and the Chick-fil-A people for getting me media pass. And once again, did my volunteering duties. Really fun time. Duke and Texas A&M. Got to see Johnny Manziel up close and personal. And that's going to be really useful for my analysis of the NFL draft coming up in the next few months. Duke was really into that game. It was a really good atmosphere. Sure, it wasn't a sellout as far as the people going to the game, but energy was high. The bands were really unique in their own separate ways, but fun time doing that. As I said, last night I was at the Hawks game, and we'll next episode we're going to delve into NBA, so I'll have more analysis of seeing the Pacers and the Hawks, but really good to actually have a media pass and deal with that, so moving up in the world as far as this sports media game goes and have a really good report on there. I'm going to get the audio up from some quotations I have from the game. I probably have that up tonight, maybe tomorrow. They play Houston tomorrow, so I may do a jumbo package of the different audios. We're kind of working on how we're going to do that. So that's what I've been doing on a personal level as far as the sports world and working my job, covering more prep sports around here. Kind of a slow period. Not much going on as far. Really, the only sports we have right now are basketball and wrestling, which is okay. But spring is coming up very soon. Going to get some tennis, lacrosse, soccer. So I'm looking forward to covering some different sports, more diversity as far as what I've been covering. Olympics, Winter Olympics are less than a month away. We'll have some analysis of that as well. Hockey teams have been named. That's been good. I've been watching some curling, trying to get back into my favorite sport from the Olympics. Curling is an interesting deal where it's a shuffleboard on ice, so the concept is very simple. As far as kind of understanding the rules, people try to make it sound like harder than it is. It's like, get most of your pins or your little curling pieces closest to the center. It sounds simple enough, but if you're an analyst and you see the strategies, it is actually very calm. It's a calming sport. A lot of sports I watch as far as like mixed martial arts, football, very heavy contact, very physical, very intense. Not that curling isn't intense, just a different type of intensity. You watch a curling match, it's just very relaxing and very chill. So I kind of like it. It's something you can watch and you feel very relaxed. So going to delve more into the Winter Olympics when it comes up over the next few weeks. And on the next episode that we do, which will probably be recorded Sunday night, maybe Monday morning, we're going to do a complete college football wrap-up. I want to talk about the title game and the media aspect of it, but we're actually going to delve into maybe the highs and lows of the season, some teams that did the best, that didn't do the best, underperformed, coaching changes. The coaching carousel is moving around quickly. And yes, my boy James Franklin, my brother from another mother, looks like he's moving on to Penn State. But hey, it's business. I'm not mad at him. But we'll delve into all that stuff. Recap the NFL divisional playoffs. Going to talk about wrestling. I know some of you aren't the biggest wrestling fans out there, so I try not to talk about it too much. But I'm going to mark out really big. Not only the stuff in the ring, which has been really good if you follow World Wrestling Entertainment and TNA and all that stuff, and we'll delve into some storylines. We'll dabble in there. But WWE recently announced that they're going to have WWE Network starting in February. And similar to UFC, which has a digital network of their own, we're going to delve into the specifics of that and the changing landscape of it. And that'll be a little bit of sports business, too. I really want to talk more sports business on the podcast as well. So that'll be a really good way to bring all of that together. And we'll also do some NBA analysis. Been a little slow with that. But now that the new year is here, a lot more has been going on. We're going to hit the NBA heavy. So expect a lot of that stuff next week as far as on the podcast and written content in connection with that. So with that, we're going to conclude the show with What Ruffled My Feathers. With this new year, people like to do their resolutions as far as what they're going to do, as far as physically, mentally, spiritually, and make new commitments with the new year as a chance to kind of clean the slate from the previous year of not being able to achieve those things and start anew. I don't really believe in resolutions per se. I believe in kind of refocusing yourself and maybe bringing your attention to things you want to improve in your life with the new year. But one thing I will really try to work on or try to analyze or do is no excuses. And not to get Tony Robbins on you or get motivational speaker on you, but a lot of times we have things in our life that say we can't do this, we can't do that. No excuses is a way to kind of push past that and achieve your dreams and achieve your goals. So when I woke up early this week and tried to go to the gym to get the health right, and the car says it's 3 degrees outside, no excuses. I got in the car, went to the gym, put in my work, and got it done. Dealing with cold weather is kind of like that in life. You know what you sign up for where you live. Now, down here in Atlanta, we had some really cold weather, temperature in the teens, even down to single digits, which true is unusual for Georgia, at least this part of Georgia. But cold weather is just a part of life that you have to deal with. If you live in the Northeast or the Midwest, you know what you signed up for by moving there or living there. Now, yes, unfortunately, some of you aren't able to move for economic reasons or personal reasons. But if you live up there, that's just part of the bargain, a part of the equation. So you can't really complain about the weather and it being too cold or being too bad if you choose to live in those locations. And as I said, not everyone can just up and move, I understand that. But if you live there, you gotta deal with it. So it's funny, and maybe because of my Northeastern attitude growing up in this weather and dealing with it, it's been funny hearing the Southerners, who aren't as used to it, talk about what they don't like about it. And it just goes back, as I said, to what I've been saying of living your life and just dealing with what you're given. And whatever that is, you have no excuse of not achieving that. So while you may be wearing your parka, or you may be in the West Coast wearing your shorts and flip-flops, those are decisions that you made of where you live. So what ruffled my feathers, and to bring it home, is the complaining about these conditions. Now, snow, I know, is terrible. Snow, there's no winters in snow. I guess the only winners in snow is if you like skiing or you like to make snowmen. Snow is fun for like the first 20 minutes. When you gotta shovel that stuff or drive in it, it is terrible. And there are some unfortunate souls that live in parts of Maine and Buffalo, New York represent, dealing with feet of snow, not inches, feet. I've seen estimates of 12 inches being the low of the feet that they're gonna, 12 inches the low of the amount of snow they're gonna get. That's a bad situation, I understand. But I've been to Buffalo, I've been to Syracuse. Beautiful places. You don't have to live there. There are other options. So, just some thoughts of people complaining about the weather and it's so cold. And to end on this note, the kids down here, man, the lack of discipline. I have my nephew, I'm not going to name which one, but he's been on the show before, said it was too cold to go to school. There's no reason for it to be too cold to go to school. I understand that people drive and have transportation and don't want to deal with the black ice and all that stuff. But there's no... In school, you're indoors. You're in a warm building. So the fact that school get canceled at the drop of a hat here for threats of cold weather, just another example of how you live in an environment and you kind of adjust to it and become soft over time. So, that what ruffled my feathers was seeing the reaction to the cold weather in Georgia and other parts of the country. Alright, thank you once again for listening to the show. Once again, the website, thesportsinquirer.net. Go to us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. Also on Facebook under The Sports Inquirer. And send me an email under sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Next show is going to be, as I said, early next week. So you know how to contact me. Until then, have an excellent night and be safe out there.